I'm Liz Crowther, and 40 years ago, I started filming a telly series called Shoestring, which I never believed would be such a sort of cult hit, and they just re-released it on DVD, and I watched some of it, which was a strange experience. It was one of the first tellies I ever did as an adult, although I played Lucy in The Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe on black and white telly when I was 12 and done various other things.
Tell us a bit about how you got into acting.
How I got into acting was, my family were actors. My darling mum was a dancer and actress, and my dad was Leslie Crowther, who had worked in theatre. He and my mum met at Arts Educational Drama School, where I went as well, and they were part of the Ovaltinis, which was a radio, young people sort of radio sketch show, as far as I know, and singing and review sort of type show. And my dad then did Crackerjack when I was little. And then I went to ballet school, where they also taught drama and got picked to play Lucy in The Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe. And I also danced in the Nutcracker with the festival ballet that they used to do a performance of it every Christmas at the Festival Hall in London. And my school provided the kids. So we had great training, but I'd also spent, you know, years in the wings and years. I spent about 5 years on tour with my dad doing this mad show called The Folderols, which was a sketch show, fast moving, singing, dancing, comedy sketch show that he was a leading light in. So I'd grown up with theatre and then wanted to be a ballet dancer, but didn't quite have what it required. And then got more interested in acting, which is a longer lasting career. I couldn't still be a ballet dancer at 63, probably. Most of them finish in their 40s, so I'm very glad that I moved into acting.
Was it easy enough to get this part in Shoestring?
In Shoestring, I think my stroke of luck was the fact that I was doing a play by Václav Havel, who was then in prison, I think, a Czechoslovakian playwright, who then went on to become the president of Czechoslovakia, and who I actually met 30 years after doing the play. And in the play, I was playing a secretary, which I also played in Shoestring. I was sort of on the front desk, if anybody hasn't seen it, a receptionist. And I played exactly the same thing in The Memorandum, this amazing play. And because it was in the round in a theatre called The Orange Tree in Richmond, I had to touch type and look like I knew what I was doing. So I did learn to type several sentences. I taught myself. So that if people looked over my shoulder, I wouldn't be just typing gobbledygook, you know, gobbledygook, that's the word, yes. Good, I'm performing tonight. So the producers came to see that play, and then I went up for an interview, and they said they'd seen me in a couple of things there and wanted to employ me as Sonia.
It sounds quite interesting, the idea that an imprisoned, later to become president of Czechoslovakia, has written it. What was the play about?
It was about the bureaucracy that you had to employ to live under a very severe communist regime. So in this office, they'd actually invented a new language, bureaucrats had invented a new language, which is called Pedidopi, where you said exaptas are najex, and there were 17 ways of saying boo. And it kind of mirrored all the other ways that you had to operate in those societies. Tom Stoppard who's also a Czech born man and is the same age as Havel, who's sadly now died, Václav Havel, although I shook his hand, which was one of the best moments of my life. And all these writers, they did very difficult things, like they would not let their children have university education, or Havel himself was employed as in a brewery. That's how they kind of made them do other work rather than having their plays produced. And so Havel actually wrote his first play about working in a brewery. And it was had an autobiographical character called Vanyek. And 30 years later, Tom Stoppard and all of the Orange Tree actors, we actually marched to the Czech embassy in 1977 because there was this amazing charter called Charter 77, which was to demand free speech for artists and for you know, dissidents in Czechoslovakia. And they actually won. They got the right to free speech. At this, the 30th anniversary of this, at the Orange Tree Theatre, which Václav Havel was present at, they performed some of his play, this play set in a brewery, in Czech, with translations for those of few of us that were in the audience who weren't Czech. And Havel himself read his character, walked on the stage. It was one of the most magnificent moments of my life.
Let's go on to talk about Shoestring. The release of it, start almost at the other end in a way. It's taken 40 years to actually get it released on DVD. It seems, I think it may have been out one or two episodes on VHS many years ago. But why, any idea why it's taken such a long time?
Some of the first series was put out on DVD, but this is the first time the whole series has been put out. And there's an accompanying booklet which talks about, well, it publishes all the casts, because there were some amazing people in it. Sharma MacDonald, the playwright, a wonderful playwright, she played a woman in a refuge in one of the episodes. There were all sorts of incredible people. Daniel Day-Lewis, I think, had a small role in it. He played a DJ. There were lots of incredible people in it, and lots of writers and directors who then went on to do extraordinary things. Marek Kanievska, who went on to direct Another Country, Martin Friend, Ben Bolt, as well as Trevor, sort of, you know, rocketing to stardom. We filmed it at Ealing Studios, which was where all the Passport to Pimlico, all the Ealing comedies had been filmed. And I think we were actually, the office was actually in the above the tank where they'd filmed The Cruel Sea in the sort of, I think it was the 1940s. So it was incredible. And then, of course, all the location stuff was filmed in Bristol, right near the Old Vic, which is where I'm going to be performing in a few weeks.
It talks in the programme, it talks about Radio West, and it starts, I think, very strong, the series, because Trevor Eve, who's this radio detective, finds himself investigating somebody on his own radio station.
I know there was one where somebody who worked there then went off and committed a lot of crimes against women, and I was heavily involved in one of those episodes.
Yeah, that's right, yeah.
I don't know whether that was the first episode?
Yeah, it was the first episode is where the presenter, presenter on Radio West is going to see a prostitute that then gets into trouble and tries to contact him on a phone-in, you know, but he wants nothing to do with her and she ends up dead. So it's quite a, you know, a powerful, I suppose, introduction between the detective and the radio station.
Yes. I think there were lots of excellent factors, like the fact that Eddie Shoestring had had a kind of nervous breakdown. He'd also worked in computers. So he was a more sensitive soul. And, of course, computers were just very embryonic at that stage. I think we see him in one shot. I've watched a whole slew of them, so that's why I get confused about some of them. But you see an entire room, you know, like all full of computers, but like all the, you know, how they used to be. It's nothing. It's like this laptop that I'm speaking to you on is it's an entire room full of hardware. It's hilarious.
What about, I mean, he's an IT casualty. Is he, do you think, television's first IT casualty character?
Perhaps, yes, indeed. And maybe, I'm not terribly au fait with loads of other detectives, but I think, I don't know how many of them have had sort of mental health problems either. Can you remember any others?
I can't. Well,
sure,
no, I can't. But I just thought it was. It was almost well ahead of its time, wasn't it? I mean, he was somebody who'd been working in IT, but just couldn't take it and had a breakdown.
Yes. And in so it was forward thinking in so many other ways. You know, the story about the women's refuge. There was a wonderful story where the actress Sandy Ratcliffe, who'd been in Ken Loach's film about a family. Oh. Anyway, she was absolutely brilliant actress, and she was being an activist by threatening to jump off the roof, complaining about her husband in prison. So there were lots of, there were punk rockers, there was, Toya Wilcox was in an episode. There were a lot of, extraordinary storylines, as well as the things that you, when I rewatched quite a lot of them recently, which is probably why I got them muddled up, lots of hilarious things like everybody smoking, people just getting out of their cars and not dreaming of locking them, people not wearing seatbelts, grass verges in the middle of motorways, sort of strange sexy calendars in people's offices that you really think, well, just wouldn't really happen now. Lots of things like that. But it's, yes, it, but at the same time, these very new ideas and quite, Trevor definitely introduced a modern style of acting. Doran Godwin, who played his lover, was a lawyer. So she was a very strong female character. Michael Medwin, who is the other regular along with me, was also a very, he'd been, I mean, actually in, as an actor, he'd been probably filmed a lot at the Ealing Studios himself, but he had a production company with Albert Finney. Yes, it was a very small but quite unusual cast, maybe.
Actually getting these things into production? Because obviously, you've got to have a kind of little boiler house there, churning these scripts out to get everything. And you've got to get those scripts beforehand. Did that all work out okay, or were there any times where you were finding you were only getting scripts at the last minute?
Oh no, I mean, compared to nowadays, where you're due to shoot a scene, and it's sort of 11 o'clock at night, or goodness knows what time at night, you might get, you know, rewritten pages, which you have to, you know by the next day. No, I think 3 weeks to shoot an episode, and that was an hour long episode. I don't know how long, maybe things like Happy Valley or some of those Broadchurch, some of those, top notch dramas, maybe they take that length of time. I'm not sure, but we certainly had, the luxury of, a good amount of time to film. Trevor tweaked with some of the scripts. I think in the booklet, I do remember reading that, some of the scripts they had to adapt, but I don't think it was that problem of scripts not being delivered on time. I think it's nowadays where a director will start a show not even knowing where what the location's like. I think that's all changed radically. So I think we were well prepped ahead, as far as I remember.
One of the constant references throughout the series is to this Bristol Mafia, although I don't know if Bristol itself is referenced. Obviously, the whole thing is filmed in Bristol. Almost a city elite that sort of run things from behind the scenes. And I think that also works quite well. I mean, do you think that helped make its popularity? Because that's got a sort of ring of truth to it, where we're now in a situation. I mean, we probably were in the 70s too, where, you know, things are people are making money, but they're not necessarily being called to account for it. And Trevor, with his investigations, was able to do something about that.
Yes. I mean, immediately springs to mind where my mum and dad lived, the pool in Bath, the rooftop pool, and the with the spring water, and how that ended up costing, you know, 40 million or something. Yes, I think that's, well, I think the 70s were definitely very activist times and very political. So yes, that probably did connect with a lot of people. Somebody, you know, a slightly sort of appearing to be shambling sort of man, but who is absolutely spot on in actually finding out the truth about things. Yes,
was there an element of the Columbo about it, do you think?
Possibly, yes. Yes, possibly. Because that was very much Trevor deciding about his clothes and sort of going for the thin ties, and he wanted the linen suits that were unironed and wanted to look like he'd sort of been, I don't know, finding information or just got out of bed or, you know what I mean? It was not a sort of very sharp-suited, detective. It was a more, I don't know what sort of approach you called it, but it was just very fresh. And with his acting style as well, I think that was, and his charm, you know, his charm. So he would manage to get Erica, his girlfriend, to provide him with all sorts of bits of information. That probably wouldn't be allowed now.
Well, you'd be surprised. What about tales while you were filming? Is there anything you can remember?
I mean, there were some funny things, like Marek Kaniyota suddenly gave me these massive, trendy glasses, and it was like, but I've never worn these before. And so I balked at that a bit, so I ended up wearing them now and again. And I also had to drive down a 1-in-8 hill in one episode, which was quite a big episode for me, where Sonia got attacked. And I'd only just passed my driving test, and that was absolutely terrifying. I had my first experience of fan letters that was unbelievable, some of the things that people wrote. Yes, I think I'm trying to remember. Gosh.
Did you really generate fan mail for you? I mean you weren't like the leading lady, were you?
No, I had the smallest part of everybody. And quite often I didn't get to go to Bristol at all. I would just shoot my few days in Ealing studios. No, it's weird. I don't know why. I got asked to lose weight. That was another thing that would be surprising now. I was asked to lose a stone and a half, before we started filming, but I was still reasonably round. Although when I look at it now, I think, goodness me. I mean, you know, how dare they have asked me to lose weight? But, so I feel like I blazed a trail for plumper actresses a bit. I seem to remember getting one fan letter that said that I was better than Vivian Leigh, Marilyn Monroe and Hedy Lamarr or something like that. It was just extraordinary. It was like out of all proportion.
Tell us about that. What role you played? Who was this Sonia?
Sonia, she was a switched on, Robert Banks Stewart, darling Robert Banks Stewart, who recently died, sadly, the producer. He described me as spiky, a spiky redhead he cast me as. So, but she just seemed an incredibly nice, bright, helpful, woman who happened to spot quite a few things, you know, when she was answering phone calls or seeing people coming in at the reception. She was a decent, hardworking girl. It was a shame that I couldn't be Bristol. But, and in fact, I'm always getting told off for sounding too posh now, but when you look at the series, I actually sound quite a bit posher, which is strange. I think that was just the time, the same way as you look back, you know, because it was blinking 40 years ago when we, you know, filmed the first episode.
Well, it ended up being a very successful series. What do you put that down to?
I think a combination of a lot of things. Like you say, the IT nervous breakdown detective that Trevor played so brilliantly in a kind of the clothes he wore, the music. George Fenton's music was a massive contribution. Bristol, beautiful Bristol, fantastic Bristol. It was a very diverse series, you know, ethnically speaking, and I don't know how common that was, apart from strange sitcoms that you wouldn't want to necessarily see again, like Love Thy Neighbor, you know, in terms of the shocking things that people said, whereas this was much more inclusive in lots of ways. It reflected Bristol. It reflected punk rock. It reflected a great many things that were happening in Bristol, though I don't think had been the centre of, you know, a location so visibly. You know, the pub was on the boat. There were lots of wonderful things to be seen around there. Lots of beautiful countryside, the docks, as well. You know, a great variety of lands of locations. It felt very young. The stories were good. I don't know. What do you think?
I think you probably got nailed it there. Great stories. Yeah, definitely good stories. And I think this, it was, there was a sort of a half of a 1970s jab at the establishment on, and of course it was 1979 and 80 where Thatcherism was all just starting. It was almost like TV's last jab at the establishment before, the Tories took over and Thatcherism started maybe.
Definitely. And I think that Shoestring kind of, he was so anti-establishment. And he had a girlfriend who, in Doran Godwin, Zerika Bayliss, that's the call.
Thank you.
That's my call because for Passage to India, I've got to go and warm up, I'm afraid. I'm coming to Bristol. I've got to plug this in A Passage to India. Bristol Old Vic, January the 30th to February the 3rd, Saturday matinee, a fantastic show. You can see Sonia with grey hair. it's in the beautiful Bristol Old Vic Theatre. It's a wonderful show, set in the Raj, but with all the, again, quite an anti-establishment novel that's turned into a play, so reflects what Shoestring first posited. So I think I have to go and warm up now.
Okay, look, before you do, I'm going to ask you one last question, Liz. Yep. What happened to TV drama? Because it's almost as if we haven't had very much since, you know, and series at the moment, which are like McMafia, which are being touted as amazing. You know, a lot of it is actually quite turgid, difficult to get through, and this was light and so much more attractive.
I blame it all on Thatcher, because when the TV franchises all got broken down, and then all of the BBC had to be producer's choice, and then they started paying some people huge salaries to be in things, and they didn't. It just, I don't know. Everything became about stars, and although having said that, I've had a blinking stand-in, so that was that was the first case of that I'd met on telly. But yes, I don't know. And then adverts, the fact that you're not allowed to have something long on television anymore. Everything has to, you know, be bite-sized, has to be over-explained. I don't know. But it was definitely one of a kind.
Just remind us where and when you're on again, please, here in Bristol.
Bristol Old Vic Theatre from January the 30th to February the 3rd, every night at 7:30 with a Saturday matinee in A Passage to India, an absolutely phenomenal novel by E.M. Forster that's been turned into a wonderful ensemble piece of theatre. I play Mrs. Moore and I also play her youngest son, Ralph. It's a fantastically diverse cast. We have beautiful music by Kuljit Bamra. Come and see it. It's bloody wonderful.
Okay, Liz, we'll let you go then. Thank you. They're probably waiting for you now. So thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you ever so much, Tony. Take care.
Bye.
Lots of love. Bye.